Swedish Ericsson.
Ericsson, thank you very much. Yeah. And you know, Ericsson produces a lot of hardware, right? I mean,
yes.
they make towers and they do all this sort of thing. So I was at a braai with him, and I said, "What are you doing?" He says, "No, I'm on my way back to Sweden." And I said, "Why?" He says, "Well, no, retraining." And I thought, "Well, this is kind of crazy. I mean, you're a pretty high-level guy. I mean, this guy was like managing director of Africa, right?" I said, "You're a pretty high-level guy to be going back for retraining." He says, "Yeah, but," he says, "the entire corporation is changing. It's changing. We're really not going to be doing hardware anymore." I said, "So if you're not going to be doing hardware, where are you going?" He says, "No, we're going to content production." I said, "Content? Yeah," I said, "content production. That's crazy." He said, "No." He says, "It's really quite logical if you think about it." He says, "You know, we can't have this battle for the manufacturing of hardware." He says, "You know, we can't compete with China, right? We can't compete with them, with Huawei, you know, subsidizing the construction of a tower. We can't do it. But what we can compete on is we can compete on what's going to be what causes people to buy things, right? What causes people to buy things is the experience. I mean, this is where Apple was so ingenious, right? Is they sold experiences. They didn't sell hardware, right? So a lot of these guys are starting to realize that it's the experience that can be different from a whole lot of different people. And not because we're not all the same exact people, we will buy different experiences. My experiences and your experiences are probably pretty aligned, but my experiences and what my wife might buy is totally different. My 21-year-old son, again, totally different. He's going to want a different experience. So the hardware won't change, but the experience will change. And that's going to be a factor of creativity, content, usage, color.
But that makes that sort of very large manufacturer of the generic. We're already there in that sense.
We are there.
It's quite masked in the sense that customization and intermediaries that do a little bit of loaded content on and a little bit of a pink phone for the ladies and a different color cover and an extra, you know, the current Samsung Edge is coming with virtual reality headsets for the people that buy the first, you know, 500, you know, those sort of add-ons. So there's packages, the people that do different packages that try create niches all the time and mine a niche.
Yeah. I mean, how many car manufacturers are there in the world? There's lots of brands,
yeah,
but there isn't very many cars. I mean, there's Fiat, there's Mahindra.
What about the future? If we were already there, what else did he say about that is yet to happen, and what it means for us? Because
what he talked about is a society that, because of the change in, you know, for lack of a better term, he was writing in a period of time where he didn't have frame of reference, right? So he was using frame of reference.
How old is the book, by the way?
It was written in 52, I think.
52.
So,
okay.
Yeah, it's quite an old book. So he was writing with this frame of reference. But what he says is in conclusion is he says, look, he says the rich will always be rich. The elite will always be elite. That's not going to change.
Yeah.
But governments will always have the opportunity to subsidize the poor and tax the middle class so that you end up with one giant buying class.
Yeah.
So you're given the illusion of choice, but there really is no choice, right? Every person in the world today using a cell phone is using a widget made by one manufacturer.
GSM.
They may think they're buying Apple. They may think they're buying BlackBerry or whatever. You know, everybody thinks they have choice, but they don't really have choice. Their choices are extremely limited. Yeah. They have the illusion of choice. And that's only going to get worse. It's only going to become exacerbated. You know, we're going to have more and more and more reduction on choice. But at the same time,
people matter about that, because to most people, that is the illusion. They don't even know that. I mean,
100%,
and until
100%.
Today, I probably didn't.
Along with that reduction in choice becomes a renaissance in creativity. Because people need to have different experiences. So, you know, we are enlightened by technology. We become aware of things that we were never aware of before. We have different expectations, different desires, different thresholds for entertainment based on what's been available to us. And so we're always looking for these different experiences. So that's where the new economy comes in. You see, the new economy is an experience economy. The new economy.
But I love
is
that. I remember all my best experience memories are experience based, not ownership-based.
There you have it. There you have it. Yeah. There was a book that was written, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago called The Entertainment Economy. And it was a really interesting concept. I mean, I think they were beginning to see what was taking place. I mean, they use Mall of America as an example. Mall of America is the largest mall in the world, and there's a requirement that you have to have an entertainment component to your shop. So you might go in to buy vegetables, but you know the vegetables might be sold to you by a dancing mouse or something, you know, because there's a requirement that entertainment has to be a component of every store that is in this mall, right? So you've probably seen it on TV. You know, the people be sitting around in a in a waiting area, and there'll be crocodiles on the floor, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, not real ones, fake ones, but you know, that's the entertainment economy. And I think that that entertainment economy is beginning to transition into the experience economy, where even entertainment now, the entertainment market, the entertainment industry, is beginning to realize that they have to offer more of an experience, which is why we see more 3D movies, and we see, you know, they're experimenting with, you know, chairs that shake and, you know, smells that get released. You know, I mean, they're experimenting with all these things.
Ukraine, we had an 8D movie experience where, apart from the chair shaking and all of that, they sprayed water on us when you went through the ride on the water and released all sorts of steam and sound and all of that. It was
there
quite entertaining for a while.
I mean, you've seen that. You've seen that new headgear uses the Samsung phone, and you use this headgear, and it gives you a 3D experience. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, you look down, you look like you're looking down. You look around. I mean, it's an incredible experience. It's a virtual reality thing, right?
Yeah.
So where we're headed ultimately, in my humble opinion, is that we're headed to this experience economy. The elite will always be the elite. The same people will own the means of production.
That sounds great, but the turmoil between getting there and now, and making sure you're one of the 500 million, not one of the 8.5.
Birth is a very painful thing.
Yeah,
you know,
well,
birth is a very painful thing.
How do we
thing.
Make sure we're not one of the stillborn that get dropped, one of the 8.5 billion that's over? And as you say, they aren't going to sweep that number of people. It's very difficult, actually, to kill large numbers of people.
It's very difficult. And some of it has to be random. You can't select. Some really good people are going to die, right? I mean, that's what happens. When they dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, I'm sure, you know, there were some people that got killed that were really valuable to the world, you know, but they perished. Because destruction is not necessarily selective, right? But what do you do to survive? You make yourself valuable. You make yourself valuable to the community. So valuable to the world.
But what about geopolitical position? Where in the map should you be? Because if it's a war, is Europe going to be the problem area again? Is it going to be Europe that
when
gets
the stuff
smashed?
Hits the when the stuff hits the fan, it goes everywhere, doesn't it? You know,
it does have a habit of going everywhere. The key thing is, you and I are not of military call-up age anymore. We're not senior citizens, but. You know, I don't know how extreme things would go, but I don't know if they're going to want a 48-year-old bloke or someone in their 50s. So, you know, you're not going to be frontline. So if you're to be deceased, you have to be a civilian casualty. Surely that it matters which country you are living in, and in terms of where this geopolitical thing is.
I think if you look at the map and you say, well, you know, where would you live or why would you want to live there? I mean, you know, the demographics of Europe, it's pretty easy to see that they're becoming, you know, quite skewed. This influx of all these people coming into Europe is going to cause a lot of turmoil. They're not going to necessarily contribute to the whole. As things get worse and worse and worse, that stress is going to become greater and greater and greater. If you look at the United States, I mean, the Americans are not used to being poor. There's 260 million registered guns in the country. They tend to be pretty aggressive when they decide to be aggressive. You could go to every country around the world and you could say this problem, this problem, this problem, this problem, this problem, this problem. I mean, a place like China, they've been oppressed for a long time. They're probably pretty used to being oppressed, and you know, they wouldn't care so much being oppressed a little bit further. They're pretty used to it.
Well, we've got people going to New Zealand, for example, billionaires apparently.
I like New Zealand.
Because it's remote.
I like Australia.
It's first world, and it the difference between New Zealand and Australia is that their government is a little bit more lowbrow and a little bit less, you know, on the cause of war and jumping in. While I would say the Australian certainly seems to be well co-opted into the sort of Anglo-Saxon message. Although I don't doubt that New Zealand wouldn't escape. But I do know that they lost their most favored nation status to the U.S. when they once refused to take nuclear waste that an American ship brought into one of their ports. And I admire them for that, for nothing else.
Me too. I mean, I think Australia is probably one of those countries that when push comes to shove, they're going to become they're going to show their liberal side, and they're probably going to be less likely to want to, you know, jump into the fray. I like Australia. I like New Zealand. Funny enough, you know, South Africa has a lot of advantages. I mean, South Africa has...
I was thinking SA is a pretty damn good place in many senses. You know, I don't know if there would be a race-based resentment if things got really hard. Do you think that's...
Yeah, but it wouldn't last long. It wouldn't last long. I mean, you know, any kind of, like, uprising likely to happen in South Africa is going to be very short-lived. Because there isn't, you know, there's an old saying in the United States that in the South, these racial tensions that the white people had a view of the black people, that they hated them as a group, but they loved them as individuals. And in the North, they love them as a group, but they hated them as
individuals.
Yeah. And I think
that's the liberal versus
liberal versus conservative, right?
Yeah.
And I think that some very much on the lines of, you know, the race based issues here are very much based on I hate you as a group, but I love you as an individual. I mean, you know, there's a lot of it takes a lot to sustain hate when you don't hate the individual. You know, it takes a lot of hate to sustain hate when you don't hate the individual. You know, you might say I want to kill all the white people, but you know, where do I start? Well, I can't kill Fricky. He's my, you know, I grew up with him, and you know, old Johan, you know, he helped my mother when she was sick. You know, I mean,
The other thing in SA's favor is it's a bit of the other side of the fence of the BRICS equation. Now it's swung very much away post the apartheid, so it's very much on the China Russia side.
Yeah, they're part of BRICS, right? So, I mean, you know, the if BRICS succeeds, well, South Africa is certainly going to be on the right side of that. I mean, the economy of South Africa is a funny thing because, you know, we are sitting at the rand conversion is close to 16 to the dollar, but that's not a real number. It's not a sustainable number, in my opinion, because our economy is essentially gold, platinum, uranium based. You know, we have metals,
the miners,
and I mean, we have a lot of metals, and we are one of the richest countries in the world.
The interesting thing is, if and lifestyle wise, it's fabulous. I don't want to over bias this to South Africa. Most of my audience is UK Northern Hemisphere, but I do think while we're in this current moribund and there's pressure on the emergings, short and medium term, it can get worse. But in the longer term, post a reset, I think it's a lot of places could do a lot better than where the States is now. So the States could fall a long way, and so can the UK.
Well, they're going to fall a long way. They got nowhere to go but down, right? So they got a long way to fall. I mean, I think really, you know, the answer to your question really should be we should be looking at geography within where you're already living. You know, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily want to be in the center of London, but I wouldn't mind being at, River on Thames or whatever, you know? I mean, if you're able to reposition yourself within England, that's probably not.
So, do you think urban areas are going to be worst hit? Because don't forget, we've got a lot of histories. I mean, even these elites, they like to preserve a bit of history and nice buildings, surely, even if they hate the people, and they know things are going to come down.
Are
we going to have the bombing of London again? Do you think?
I think that you're most likely to see things like food riots. You know, and food riots usually occur. They usually occur in high concentrations of population. So the population density of London is a hell of a lot higher than it is in some of the remoter areas. Right? So, you know, I mean,
we're going to get a reverse urban sprawl. Where everyone goes to the farmers and as opposed to get a bit of land, a bit of food, and all of that, and get away from the urban areas, instead of the concentration in urban areas.
Well, yeah, I think that we probably are going to see certainly when it all hits the fan. You know, people don't generally get in their car and drive to the center of New York City.
No.
You know, they tend to try to get away.
It's real funny, you know, Mark, you won't appreciate this, but there's a place called Blackwall Tunnel here in the UK. My UK listeners will have a wry smile right now. And it's essentially a two-laner either way that goes under the River Thames. And it's quite a critical, you know, whenever you have a city based around the river, it cuts a city in two. And we had a day, I don't know quite what happened, whether it was a planned stoppage or a break, and it was unfortunately the day I came back from my holiday and I had to drive across London. And the gridlock, man, you couldn't believe it. You couldn't get anywhere. I stopped the car, switched the engine off, people were getting out, the whole story. It took me about 4.5 hours to get home, driving from Heathrow. And it was an absolute nightmare. And that was essentially one byroute that went under a river with two lanes in each direction. You couldn't do anything for the entire of Southeast London. Everybody was broken down. And I was thinking, man, I think that motorbike's just come up the priority list. Apart from entertainment, you can get the hell out of Dodge a whole bunch quicker. Just imagine everybody has to get out of London in a simultaneous day or two. The extent of carnage on the roads that you would face if what I was describing was just on a single byroute involving two lanes in both directions.
It can't happen. I mean, when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, I mean, all these people were cut off because there's just you can't have 10 million people on a road trying to get out. The road was not built for that, right? So you could be sitting in your Rolls Royce, and the guy's going by you in an old, fraught motorbike, but he's going and you're not.
Exactly, he's moving and
you're stuck.
That's again the concept of value, the tool for the moment. You need 100%. To have the right tool for the condition, and that 100%. A high value in the current condition is not 100%. Necessarily high value in the next.
I think it's the illusion is the illusion for a lot of people is they just don't want to let go of the 20th century, and they keep wanting to go back to the way it was. You know, let's go back to Ronald Reagan. Let's go back to the 80s. Let's go back to let's go back to the 90s. Let's go back to even the boom prior to the collapse in 2008. Let's go back to that time and let's live that. And they don't realize that it's gone. It's not that the trajectory of the recovery is different or what. There is no recovery. We're not going to recover from fundamental changes. Nobody recovers from having their leg cut off. Day is finished. And this is one of the frustrations I have with a lot of people. I mean, when I do talks, when I talk to people, the audience, a lot of times they just don't understand. You know, they want to debate things that are ridiculous, like the trajectory of the recovery.
You get what you probably to build on your Titanic, the deck chair shufflers on the Titanic. Want to move. They move that around and get them in the right place. It's no point. Absolutely, you need to see the big game. We're both big game view people. We like the we're eagles in the sky, and we want to see the whole lie of the land rather than trees in front of us next in this particular forest. And unfortunately, it stretches the things you have to potentially perceive in your mind's eye. Is a great stretch to your entire life experience. You have to actually stretch and think about things that you've never experienced in your entire life. Many people have never experienced a food shortage or being hungry. Many people, just thinking of bullets as currency is absurd. Some of the things we've said, a lot of it is doing me thinking about a motorcycle and the reason to get out of Dodge, not just for entertainment, a lot better than on a car to get out to a bug out area. Things like that. Venezuela and Ukraine, their immediate knee-jerk responses to potential fiscal ailments and conflict, and then a major economic reset in the case of Venezuela and to a degree Ukraine, how everything responds. They think that only happens in these places. In other words, they have an elitist kind of thinking, oh, I live in London. We know what we're doing.
Until it happens, I live in New York or the States.
That's what happens in third world countries, you know. And unfortunately, we are all third world right now. In terms of the macroeconomic setup, you know, we've all fought ourselves into a corner that we can't get out of. So one of the things you did in the final bullet, and then I think I'll call it a day, and it's been intriguing and very, very interesting. You mentioned that possibly George Bush had a plan to eliminate the dollar in 2008.
Yeah, this is a really, really interesting thing. I mean, and some of this some of this is really easy to prove, and some of it is just sort of logical conjecture. But, you know, when there were some really interesting things happening in the world around 2007, 2008. And we had China starting to exert itself. We had Russia starting to exert itself. There was, you know, we weren't that far out of the 2001 World Trade Center experience. We were still fighting. There was a lot of things going on. And there were some things that took place that were before the collapse that kind of gave me a different view on the collapse. You've heard of the Amero.
Yes.
Okay, so
for those that haven't, that's the alleged North American currency replacement involving Mexico, Canada, and the U.S.
Yeah, it's not even alleged. It's just not
acknowledged openly.
Yeah, it's just not in place. I mean, nobody denies that. It's on the congressional record, the Amero.
Right, so I didn't know that.
They've discussed it in Congress. So I mean, it wasn't something that was dreamed up by some conspiracy.
It wasn't a figment
of someone's imagination, some fantasy writer somewhere. This was something they really truly discussed. I mean, they had NAFTA, which is the North American Free Trade Association, which kind of, you know, it was sort of like the creation of a Eurozone for America. And at the same time, they put a lot of protocols in place, and they discussed the idea of having a single currency, the Amero. Now, one of the big problems when you transition a currency is that the banks have lent money and people have done transactions that are denominated in a currency. So if I borrowed $1 million from the bank, let's say, to build my house, my contract would say that I owe them $1 million. Yep. It doesn't say I owe them $1 million plus whatever currency they change it to, right? I owe you $1 million. So if I'm going to change currency, it's a huge problem because all those contracts have to be revised. You see, I can't really even do it by an act of Congress or anything because it's dealing in an area of law that's pretty well established. It's contract law, right? So I have to be concerned about money that are in, how much money is in savings and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of things that I have to take into account. But most importantly is I've got all this debt out there that is denominated in a certain currency. So, well, how do you get rid of that? Well, in the United States, people don't save much. Okay, I mean, there was a report that came out the other day. It was on Bloomberg. They were talking about it today, as a matter of fact, where how shocking it is that they say most Americans, the figure I think was 92% or something of Americans, if they had to pay a $1,000 bill, there was an emergency bill that had to be paid for $1,000. They couldn't meet it. They don't have $1,000 in cash. So most Americans don't maintain cash. They aren't able to save cash because of tax and this and that. But even the wealthy don't keep cash. You know, I mean, the average is 15%. It's sort of like, you know, 15% of your entire wealth is held in liquid form in the form of cash. So even Bill Gates isn't going to hold that much cash. He's going to have his money invested in assets, a lot of paper assets, but he's going to have assets. Okay, so if you were to do, if you were to change the currency, that wouldn't really be too big a factor because, you know, if the guy has $300 in his bank account and it's gone, well, it's not going to ruin his life. You know, you can give him a tax credit or something to cover that, right? So the big problem, again, was debt. So we owed trillions to the rest of the world, and the Chinese and all these people were putting pressure on us, and they were trying to put pressure on us in terms of our position in the Middle East and war and this and that. And, you know, the guys that we owed money to were starting to maybe exert a little bit too much effort in trying to dictate our policy than the president was very comfortable with, right? So all of that is sort of fact. You know, you can prove that. Now, this part is also fact, but there's nothing to necessarily tie them together. But when we had the collapse, the really, really interesting thing that happened in the collapse was that the U.S. government stepped in and literally brought trillions of dollars to the table to buy all this debt. So the American government, for the first actually be owner of the debt. I mean, they bought all the, you know, I mean, they were rescuing the FDHA, and they were rescuing all these different people. And as a result of this, they were buying all this toxic debt. They called it all toxic debt. As a result, I mean, there was trillions. I mean, I've heard numbers like 7 trillion, 9 trillion, 14 trillion, numbers all over the place that they spent buying up all this debt. So they're in a situation where they are suddenly the originator of debt. Now, the amazing thing about them being the originator of debt is that if at that point in time they decided to change the currency, they wouldn't have the same problems the banks have. Because the governments all over the world have this little thing in the law called eminent domain, which gives them the right to say, you have a mortgage with us denominated in dollars, we want you to change it to Ameros or whatever, and if you don't do it, it becomes a matter of national security and we're going to take your land by eminent domain. The law's in place. All we have to do is say that it's, you know, it's an issue of security for the government and we can take your land.
Wow.
Gone, right? So he actually...
Everyone complies in those circumstances, as you can imagine.
They have no choice. They have no choice because it's, you know, if it's not you, it's someone else. I'll take your land. Now I've been compensated for the loan. You know, I'll just sell it to someone else and give them a loan, right? So there was no risk to them in that. So you have a situation where very few people would be hurt in terms of, you know, cash in the bank. Almost no, they would have the ability to handle the issue of the legal contractual problems regarding debt because they bought all the balance sheets of the banks. They bought them all. They bought all the debt everywhere. And they were in a position to then issue this new currency and tell the whole rest of the world, go fly a kite. Screw you. Screw you. At the time, I don't know what it was. I think it was something like $12 trillion or whatever it was. The 9 to 10 or $12 trillion that we owe you, eat it. Eat it. Because we'll pay you back in dollars, but we don't use dollars, so the dollars are worthless. Everybody else in the world would be dead, and America would suffer very, very little.
They could have done, in other words, they could have done a job lot renege and utilized a new currency implementation as it.
Yes.
But then wouldn't that have been very much a smoking gun towards it being an entire engineered situation anyway?
Well, it would have been a bit self-evident. It would have been that. It would have caused chaos in the rest of the world. It would have caused a lot of things. I mean, there was a lot of, I mean, it didn't happen. But the point that I'm trying to make is that they engineered a condition. They engineered a situation where it could happen. Because there's something that took place there. I mean, everybody talks about the collapse, and we all know about the derivatives, and we all know about Lehman, and we know all about that stuff.
Could it be then the hypothesis that we could make, because we want to be forward-looking all the time, that the next one could be the one where they do the leap and go currency-driven?
I think that the most likely scenario is that there will be
straight to SDR world currency?
I don't think so. I think that there has to be some sort of a massive shakeup beforehand. You know, in reality, I think that that whole scenario was engineered almost as a test to turn around and say, okay, what happens if we do this? Well, the United States.
I have a theory on that very one, and I want to tie this in before you go any further. Is remember the bailout of long-term capital?
Yeah, sure.
Essentially, a lot of very wealthy people, a very insider money was tied in with that. It all went bad. It had the brightest men in the room. That's hence all the books by that name, et cetera, et cetera. You and I know the option price guys, Scholes, and I think Black, one of them was with them.
Yeah.
I think it was Myron Scholes. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think it was Scholes. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was.
Anyway, they were all involved in that particular long-term capital. And I wondered if... They got bailed out essentially by the government, and they created that crisis. They gave it quite a lot of airtime, and they wanted to see. I wondered often if that was almost a drill, or it got utilized as a drill. It may have just been convenient and come about. I'm not saying the collapse was engineered, but they certainly went for the government bailout, and they got away with it with very limited backdraft from the citizenry, because essentially that was the first time that you, well, it wasn't the first time, you had the savings and loans crisis as well, but those were banks. This was actually a hedge fund, you know, the taxpayer effectively bailed out a hedge fund only because it was considered too big to fail. That was the first introduction for me of too big to fail. And of course, it protected a lot of insider money that had gone in there as well, and a lot of insider brains. And I wondered, that was a perfect drill for them to go for the big one on subprime. And there was no blowback at all on that. There was no rioting in the streets.
These guys observe, you know, things that happen, and they say, okay, well, that'll work. I mean, you know, the little known, the thing that nobody harps on, but it always like gave me a bit of, you know, they call it in a Sicilian, they say agito, a bit of stomach problem, is, you know, the algorithm they use that supposedly resulted in the entire collapse of the world system was written by a Chinese mathematician. And who benefited from all that? You know? I mean, China probably suffered the least from that whole thing, right?
You're talking about long-term capital, or
no? I'm talking about the collapse. You know, they were using an algorithm for pricing.
Yeah,
they were using an algorithm that predicted that was a predictive algorithm that allowed them to come and say this is AAA paper and blah blah blah. They were using an algorithm. It was written by a Chinese guy, a Chinese mathematician.
Yeah.
So, you know, my point to all of that is that. In 2008, the little known thing is that the U.S. government really became the originator of virtually all the debt in the country. Yeah. They bought it all up. And that you can check that. I mean, that's not a conspiracy theory, you know, right? So, you know, they were bailing out AIG. They were buying up all the taxes. There was all that sort of thing. That put them in the perfect position to issue a new currency. However, it would have wiped out the rest of the world. So
which would have had blowback for America in
some 100%. We would have been at war, it would have been bad for everybody, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But you see, I think what it proved, you know, we were putting it in terms of, you know, the elite and all that, you know, the conspiracy theory that we've been sort of discussing all the way along. You know, I think maybe that they created that scenario and then they realized, but if we do it this way, it's going to be really painful. For us, not for the, you know, we don't care about the rest of the world. It's going to be painful for us. This is going to be hard to control. So maybe we need a few interim adjustments beforehand. You know, in the military, they call it shaping. We need to shape the battlefield a bit, you know. We need a few explosions to kind of drive the troops in that direction so that we can then carpet bomb them and take them out. So, you know, maybe that shaping was taking place, and there's still more shaping to take place. And what form that's going to be, you know, stock market collapses, wars, you know, there's a whole lot of things that can happen that would further shape us and further shape us. In the end, you know, they talk about, you know, societies, shaping society to the point where they don't have to arrest you and throw you in a debtor's prison or whatever. You beg to go there so that you can get fed.
Yeah.
You know, that's a much easier way of getting you to prison.
Yeah. Yeah. And much easier to spend money on guards. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, interesting.
So
final closing, Mark, a prep, a trade, a positioning for our audience. What would be your top tip for preparation for reset day?
Look, I mean, it's what we've been discussing all along. I mean, you have to have real value, you know. That's the easiest way to achieve that. You pay a premium for coins, but coins are the most easily recognizable value.
Yeah.
Again, I wouldn't be buying only 1 ounce coins. I'd be buying a various range of coins, you know, buy eighths, quarters, whatever, you know, halves.
Well, the key is get started, first of all. And
yeah, you buy what you can buy. You buy what you can buy, and even if you had all the money in the world, you'd want a selection of these things.
Correct.
And then also to start turning around and saying, okay, well, you know, what could I have? What could I spend money on? What could I invest in that I don't necessarily see as value today, but could be value in a particular environment? I mean, that bullet concept blew my mind. It absolutely blew my mind.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, traditional investments, Mark, like an equity tracker. On a technology index, would that survive if someone took the long run view that all they did is they drip fed monthly a certain amount
I think the technology is too, it's too hot.
It's too hot now. You certainly could take a dip. I'm talking about, okay, I'm 48 now. I want to retire when I'm 70. And I want to see, I want to have something in the pot that's grown for me over that time. I don't intend to touch it. Here's 22 years. You know, let's go for it. And I did that.
You know, I think I would probably look at second tier type stocks. You know, if you've got Apple, that's
small
flying,
cap then, or mid cap.
Yeah, mid cap, small to mid cap, but guys that are supplying players. You know, you often find, like, you know, Apple might be selling at 30 times earnings as an example, right? Yeah. But the guy who sells them the clip that goes on the outside of the iPhone, he's selling at 5 times earnings.
Yeah.
But as Apple grows, he grows.
Yeah.
As Apple sells, he sells, right? So it's kind of that second tier.
Yeah, there's too much valuation, there's too much fluff, and there's too much steam, and there's too much of a bumpy ride to come for any lump sum investing. That's not what I would say, and we're not regulated to give investment advice either. So
it's purely
for entertainment purposes, but just in terms of positioning. I hear you, and I think what you're saying is try find some value in the tech space, which means going downstream one derivative, basically.
100%. 100%. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's materials that get used in the production of technology, and those are really undervalued right now, generally. You know, raw materials, and I'm talking
rare
about
rare earths.
I mean, I'm talking about, you know, I mean, those things are undervalued relative to the high. You know, in the things, you know. So, I mean, that's for me, for my, you know, investment strategy and everything right now, you know, I mean, I won't buy a pack of gum so that I could buy another sliver of gold. I mean, that's where I'm at right now.
Yeah.
You know, I like it. I mean, I like it for a million different reasons, not the least of which is.
You can't print it.
Well, and it's just a hedge against everything. You know, I mean, I live in a country that, you know, the currency has problems. But if I have gold, it doesn't matter because I can sell gold for whatever.
Yeah.
I don't have to sell it for dollars or pounds or euros or rands or whatever. I could sell it for anything.
Yeah.
I can exchange it for rubles if that's what I want. Right?
Yeah.
So it hedges on so many different levels. So that's me. I mean, I probably along the lines of Jim Rogers in that area. You know, Jim Rogers is a big metals guy, you know?
Yeah, yeah, I know him well. And he also says the farmers will be rich again, which is an interesting one. But it means the producers of food. And it'll be nice to see some money flowing their way instead of the supermarket chains. Mark, been awesome.
Great talking to you, Francis. Yeah. Thank you.
Pleasure. 2 hours and 7 minutes, and I'm going to break this up into chunks if I can do that in a neat and succinct way. Thank you very much for coming on to the Reset Podcast. Delighted and intriguing. By the way, is there anything you would like to say? If there's anyone who hears something or finds you interesting, wants to get in contact for...
Yeah, you know, let me just give my email. So if anybody wants to email me, you know, I have some... I sent you my book. I don't know if you've read it, but, I'm happy to apply the zero marginal cost of philosophy and send it to everyone who wants to read it.
That's the serial give us the full title,
it's
the serial.
Confessions of a Serial Entrepreneur.
Confessions of a Serial Entrepreneur, Mark Bruno. Can I give your email out as Mark?
So that's
Mark, M-A-R with a K, dot Bruno, B-R-U-N-O, at mweb.co.za. That's ZA is for South Africa. Intriguing gentleman to speak to and to learn from. Great insights on the machinations of the government behind our government as well. Incredible ear. And Mark, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Francis.
And I look forward to maybe having a follow-up chat in some time
me
when
as well.
News. All the best to you.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.